Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If your computer could talk, what would it say to you? More importantly, what would it say about you? While most of us use firewalls and spy blockers to ensure anonymity when we click search and buy, researchers are able to find interesting and revealing patterns in the places we go and the things we look for when we are online. Bill Tanser does it for a living in his job as general manager of global research at the consulting firm Hitwise. In large part, his job is to help corporate clients predict trends and craft online marketing strategy. But he admits that he lives for the days when his research reveals a surprise, what he calls an enigmatic data point, that doesn't jibe with conventional wisdom about online activity or about human behavior in general. Like the surge in searches for prom dresses around the first of the year, months before most teens even have a date, let alone a chance to hunt down party dresses in brick-and-mortar stores. So why January? He explains how that vexing question led him to his obsession with research in his new book, Click, What Millions of People Are Doing Online and Why It Matters. Bill, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
You say the internet itself is changing the way we experience the world. Can you explain that?
Sure. You know, if you look at the patterns of usage that we've had as a society with the internet over the last several years, more and more things are transitioning from offline to online. Just think about your everyday life and how when you may have looked at the movie times in a newspaper and now you do it on a website, or you look at a Craigslist classifieds ad versus going to the newspaper and looking for classifieds, or even interact and message with people on social networks. More and more, every day, the internet's becoming more ingrained in our lives.
We should start at this point talking about how you compile your data. You have agreements to collect information not with search engines, but with internet service providers. What kinds of information do you collect?
That's correct. We get our information on a network level. So what we do is we have agreements with ISPs. They install software on their networks that takes all the traffic that's going across their servers. It anonymizes and aggregates the data. We're not interested in tracking individuals. We're more interested in just tracking aggregate trends. So what percent of internet visitors in any given time went to this website or searched on this specific term? So that software gathers that information, strips out any personally identifiable bits, and then puts it into our servers where we can then slice and dice it and analyze the data, which is really the basis for what I've written about in Click.
Yeah. Can you chunk it all together so that you don't know the name or the address or the age of a certain person, but you can tell, for example, what 50 websites that person looked at in a week?
Yeah, I can't even go down to the person. So all of the information that would identify a session or where someone was coming from is all removed. What I see instead is that MySpace was the number one website in this given period, and it was visited by this percent of the internet population.
What makes the web a better source of information about what we want to know and what we actually do than other forms of media?
You know, we're just tapping into the internet and usage data as a source of information, something that might be very complementary to survey information, which is the primary way that we as market researchers have gathered information about society and what we think, what we care about. The problem with surveys is that, well, there's a couple problems. The first one is reaching a representative sample of the population. One problem with that is that these days, most random digit dial phone polls only call landlines. And if you've seen some of the latest numbers that have come out in terms of households that are cell phone only, also called cord cutters, it's upwards of 19, some even say 20% of all U.S. households. Well, that specific segment of the population of a random digit dial poll is not calling cell phones, is not addressed within the survey. So there's a problem with representativeness. The second thing, which has plagued surveys for as long as I can remember, is the problem with cognitive dissonance. It's getting people to answer questions honestly rather than answering questions in the way they think that a survey a pollster might want them to answer the questions, or also answering questions in a way to put themselves in the best light. If you look instead at observed behavior, like the aggregate behavior that we track at Hitwise, it sometimes shows a much different picture from what we see in survey responses.
What you can tell about political contests is very interesting, because you could just track the number of times people search for, say, the name John McCain as opposed to the name Barack Obama, but you have to be more subtle than that.
You do, and here's the one thing that I'm asked most. I've done all sorts of predictions using this data, and I've been very successful in predicting the results of reality television shows with a couple that I missed. Close but didn't quite get it. I'm often asked, based on that type of analysis, whether or not I can predict the results of this upcoming presidential election, for example. And the answer to that question is no, because something very interesting happens with our internet behavior around politics, and that is, the closer you get to an election, the more crossover visits occur between candidates. So someone who supports Barack Obama might be visiting the John McCain site, not because they support John McCain, but because they want to find out what's McCain's position so that I can then formulate arguments against what he stands for, or vice versa. So that crossover traffic actually, it'll manifest itself in increased visits and searches on those candidate names the closer you get to election. That obfuscates who's the most popular. But what's really interesting is if you look at the search terms that are associated with a candidate over time, sometimes you can understand what we as a society are thinking about these particular candidates based on the popularity of the search terms around their names.
So in other words, you could put a candidate's name and then put service record or family values, or you could put jokes or scandals right next to that same name, and that would tell you something.
Absolutely. So, for example, if we look at Barack Obama and John McCain, there were over 6,000 different unique ways that people were searching for Barack Obama these last 4 weeks, and about 5,000 different ways that people were searching for John McCain. And then if you ranked all of those unique searches in terms of the number of times they were searched, you can get an understanding of what people are searching for, and it's somewhat surprising. It's not what I would think it would be. I would assume a lot of people would be searching about the political stance of the candidates. What we find in the search data in the top search terms, it's a lot about the celebrity of the candidate and even things about image. How tall is Barack Obama? How old is John McCain? Questions about their family. You can see in the search terms questions around John McCain's daughter and whether or not she had lunch with Heidi Montag, a reality TV star, at a Santa Monica restaurant.
What sorts of things are people searching for with regard to Sarah Palin these days?
Well, yeah, it's a very interesting question. In fact, I have a column that just went up on Time.com, my Science of Search column, where I analyzed the searches for Sarah Palin. Here's the interesting thing about her is that as we charted the search terms on all of the candidates and their running mates, so looking at Barack Obama, Joe Biden, John McCain, and Sarah Palin, she is the most searched for just this last week of any political figure over the last 3 years. And if we look at what people are searching for, there's a number of different things. There were over 1,000 different uniques that we captured just in this last week, but a lot of searches for pictures of Sarah Palin, specifically hot pictures of Sarah Palin.
Well, she was on the cover of Vogue magazine.
She was on the cover of Vogue magazine, and also it seems as though a lot of internet users have clued into the fact that she also was a beauty pageant contestant, and they're looking for pictures from that pageant, and specifically looking for the bikini pictures from that pageant.
One thing that I thought was interesting is that you found that if we were to tell, say, a pollster about the things that we fear the most, that seems to differ pretty significantly from the fears that we investigate online.
That's exactly right. You know, one of the things that we did with our data, and this was one of those just turning points in the analysis that we had with the data a few years ago, is we looked at all the search terms that we capture, and we have the ability to take this massive database of millions of search terms and filter it just for some specific terms. So one of my analysts had this great idea of just filtering out those search terms that contained fear of. And what happened when we did that is we identified 1,300 unique fears, and we were able to rank them in terms of their occurrence. And so on the top of the list, this particular period was fear of flying, then fear of heights, and fear of clowns. But as we got into the list and we started to bucketize some of these terms and understand the categories for which people searched, there were two searches that occurred time and time again. One was the fear of intimacy, or some variation of that term, and the other was fear of being alone. And if you look at the incidence of the two, they were almost tied. Now, if you compare that to some of the surveys that have been done via polling, via telephone polling, there's a much different list. And the difference between what we were able to see in internet behavior and what a pollster might see by doing a phone survey is that social fears don't appear in the traditional survey. But social fears do show up quite often within internet behavior, and that kind of makes sense. If you have a social fear and you're on the phone talking to somebody that wants to survey you about that fear, first of all, maybe not likely that you'd actually participate in that survey. And second, are you going to admit to that fear? And then some of the strange fears that we see. If you go down to the bottom of the list of these 1,300 fears that we were tracking, there's some really strange ones. There's things like fear of elbows, fear of ceiling fans, fear of belly button lint. And these are things you probably also would never hear about on a survey, one, because these are in the long tail of fear searches, but also if you have one of these bizarre fears, how likely are you to admit it to somebody who's conducting a survey?
Bill Tanser is my guest. His new book is called Click, What Millions of People Are Doing Online and Why It Matters. It speaks to something else, I think, the whole fear question, Bill, and that's that people might define it in a different way. You might think that you suffer from a fear of intimacy or someone that you care about does, but it doesn't come across to many people like a phobia if people are asking about what you're afraid of.
Yeah, that's very true, and that's one of the challenges with analyzing this data is that you have to start to understand or try to understand the intent behind some of these searches. For example, if you take the fear of intimacy query, it could be very much that somebody has that fear of intimacy, or it's also likely it could be somebody has a question about fear of intimacy more concerned with their significant other. So which is it? And you have to factor that into the analysis when you look at all of these different queries.
I'm curious how you do factor that in, because you could certainly, on the more bizarre fears, I actually am mildly displeased by clowns, but say that you hear about something and you just think it sounds interesting. You can type that in without having it directly relate to you at all.
And that's very true as well. Sometimes you may just have a curiosity about that specific topic or fear. But if we look at this behavior in aggregate, if we look at what 10 million people are typing in terms of their search terms overall, I think you're going to see a lot of that normalize out, and you will be able to identify some reoccurring fears that people are searching for.
You found that confessional sites are incredibly popular.
They are growing in popularity, I think mostly due to the book Post Secret. And Post Secret had a website, I believe they still have a website that's active, that came from that book, where people are just posting anonymous confessions to websites. And we've started to see a number of different sites, specifically those that are dedicated to new moms, as well as some other niche confessional sites. So people actually have found some release in being able to type up these confessions in a form that no one will ever be able to identify them with, you know, that particular confession, but they're able to make it public. And I guess it's somehow cathartic for them.
I think the really interesting thing about the confessional sites is that I suppose they fill the need for people who need to confess things, and also they really appeal, in a sense, to voyeurs.
Yeah, they do. It really does serve both sides of the coin, those that want to confess and those that want to hear about them. And I think those of us that want to see some of those confessions, it might be this need to kind of associate with others. Do others, have they done things that I might have done? Can I get some solace in looking at these confessions to know that whatever I've done maybe is not that unusual or not that bad.
And there is a significant percentage of people who sort of lurk on these kinds of sites but never contribute anything themselves.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, there's a whole chapter in the book where we've studied Web 2.0 and this act of participating online. And what we found is that it's less than 1% of all internet visits, when we look at most Web 2.0 sites, are actually attributable to somebody participating. And it's a lot more than just, you know, look at things statically.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in just a minute. The 80-20 rule is out the window, and now, according to Bill Tanser, it's the 1-9-90 rule. We'll talk more about that and about the book Click, What Millions of People Are Doing Online and Why It Matters, after the break. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Bill Tanser. He's General Manager of Global Research for the consulting firm Hitwise. His new book is called Click, What Millions of People Are Doing Online and Why It Matters. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. So, Bill, for several years now, people, particularly those within the internet industry, have talked about the excitement of user-generated content. Has that been overstated?
I don't know that it's been overstated. You know, we can just look at the sheer amount of content that's available since Web 2.0 sites have really come about and have flourished. What I think we do need to look at, though, is just how many people are actually participating. So about 2 years ago, we decided to launch into a little study using our data that internally we called Web 2.0, which is trying to figure out who actually is participating and how many of the internet populace are actually actively participating. So one thing that we looked at is a bunch of Web 2.0 sites, and we looked specifically for people participating. An example might be on YouTube, somebody uploading a video to YouTube, or for Flickr, uploading photos, or Wikipedia, editing or entering an entry into Wikipedia. And what we found, while we assumed that the 80-20 rule would apply, that 20% of the online populace supplied 80% of all the content, what we actually were able to prove is that a ratio that Jacob Nielsen developed, which was the 1-9-90 rule, is probably more applicable to Web 2.0. And when I say 1-9-90 rule, what Jacob Nielsen had formulated and what we altered just a little bit is that about 1% or less of the internet populace actively participates by uploading their own user-generated content. About 9% of us might interact by adding comments to existing user-generated content or regular content. And then 90% of us just statically view that content. So we coded up all of these different sites to look at participation, and we sat back for a month and let it capture data. And what we found for YouTube, for example, is that it was about 0.5% of all visits were attributable to somebody uploading a video. For Flickr, it's about the same percentage. Wikipedia was a little different. It was almost 5 to 6% of all visits were somebody editing or supplying a brand new entry to Wikipedia. What we found out over time is that there's a slippery slope of participation. The easier it is, so if it's just textual, like Wikipedia, you get a higher percentage. And if it was something a little bit more technically involved, like creating a video and uploading it, those percentages tended to center around 0.5, 0.6%. So it looked like the data that we were capturing did, in fact, confirm Jacob Nielsen's 1-9-90 rule.
An interesting surprise about things like YouTube, you found that rural folks are more likely to upload their own videos than urbanites.
Yes, you know, in some data points I can't always explain, and I could come up with a couple of theories, but there might be some narrative fallacies if I do that. But what we found is if we looked at the spread of what we call urbanicity, which I don't think is a real word, but, you know, whether people are coming from an urban area, suburban, a small town, or a rural area, it was the rural areas were more likely to upload a video to YouTube. One theory that I've heard since I've been talking about this is that maybe people in rural areas just have more time to upload these videos, but I don't know if that's true. That's just one theory that's out there.
Well, I wonder, too, if they might feel like their lives are less reflected in the regular media.
That could be as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Bill Tanser. The new book is called Click, What Millions of People Are Doing Online and Why It Matters. Let's speak to Lori in Denton. Hi, Lori.
Hello. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
I just wanted to comment that, you know, Google will be 10 years old this month. And I've been using Google for about, 9 years. And how much it's changed our lives, just the search engines. I no longer go to a phone book. I don't use a phone book anymore. I go to Google, and I Google it, and how it's a part of our phrase. And I just think it's amazing these 10 years what that search engine has done. I use it hundreds of times a day at my job. I say 100. I use it many times a day at my job. And I just want to comment that it's amazing how information is just at a click. And is that covered in your book?
Laura, yes, it is. It's in fact, I talk about how, you know, there's so much that we can tell from the way people are searching and really how that's evolved over time. So I've been involved in the search industry going back to about 1997. and have analyzed data since then. And one thing that we found is really interesting. If we go back in the early days, people were searching on very generic things, very simple things. And this may be the case for you as well. If you go back to your early days of using Google or other search engines, you might have just typed in cars or some very generic term. What we found over time is that the number of words per search query that we're using is growing. It's growing every single month. And now it's not uncommon in our data to see 5, 6, 7 word queries where people have learned that they can search for very specific things. And we also have shown that just the volume of our own searches in terms of other internet activity continues to grow, which confirms, as you're saying, that it's just become so integral. We're using it more and more to find information.
So do we use more words because we're more sophisticated or because we simply don't want to waste our time, or maybe both?
Yeah, the sophistication question is a really interesting one, because in the early days, I believe it was actually the less sophisticated users were using multiple word queries because we were typing in natural language questions to search engines, like, where can I find a car? Versus, you know, people just typing in car and getting the same results. But I think now what we find, if you actually look at these queries, is that instead of typing in car, it's evolved to people typing in maybe Volvo, and then Volvo S70, and then Volvo S70 1990 model, and then even that whole long string with the zip code to find a local listing for that specific car. So I think it definitely is showing us that people are becoming more sophisticated, and they know that if they get very specific in their query, they're more likely to get the information they're looking for.
Let's talk about the prom dress thing that came up in the introduction.
Yes.
You have found that online shoppers now really dictate the season for particular products as opposed to merchandising needs that take place with a brick-and-mortar retailer. And some of this research started when you discovered that people search for prom dresses in an inordinate number in January.
That's right, and I've become very well known in the online marketing space for my obsession with prom dresses. But you know, this is really a fascinating example, and this I can't claim responsibility for. It was actually my analyst, Leanne Prescott, first discovered this. We were looking at just all the search terms in general that people were searching for that resulted in visits to retail sites. And I'd asked Leanne to do an analysis for me and tell me what the top generic terms were. You know, what we find, actually, is a lot of people will type in domains and brand names of stores into search engines. I didn't want to look at that. I was more interested in what type of things were people searching for. And after doing this analysis for a few weeks, she came back to my office, and she was very concerned. And she said, Bill, we've got a problem with the data. The number one type of thing people are searching for among, it was like over 20,000 retail sites, was the term prom dresses. And I thought that was strange, but I wasn't ready to really call a general alarm. And then she reminded me that it was January was when we pulled this data. And so we charted the searches on prom dresses over time. And sure enough, every first week of January was the peak, the first initial peak in searches on prom dresses. And when I see a pattern like that, I know it can't be something that's artificially generated. It really is something that we're seeing in the data. So my next step was to call up some of our clients that were in the apparel space, retail apparel space, department stores. And all of them confirmed that they put prom dresses out in March, and they put prom dresses front and center on their websites in March, and they felt there was something wrong with our data as well. And it wasn't until I was presenting at an online publishers conference that at the end of the presentation, this very distinguished gentleman walked up to me afterwards and handed me a card, and he said, "Son, I'm all about prom dresses." I thought, well, this might be the answer here. And he proceeded to tell me that he ran a major publishing house's online division, specifically the teen division. And what he told me was that over time, the publishing industry, in order to extend the advertising season for prom dresses, had started to create these fashion editions of their fashion magazines that were all about prom fashions for the upcoming year. We're putting them out in December and January. And he said, "Your data is actually proving to us that we've changed consumer behavior, because now we can see that our readers are actually searching for those prom dresses in January." But the interesting thing, though, is that there was an inefficiency in the marketplace, because the department stores, who are clients of ours, didn't understand that peak actually existed. They were planning for March. And even though girls aren't buying their prom dresses in January, as a retailer, you probably want to be top of mind as soon as the research starts. And you know, since then, we've been talking about this example for about 3 years now. I think we're finally seeing some changes in the marketplace, and retailers are understanding that trend, and they're modifying their marketing programs to fit it.
So it would make sense that, say, a department store or a young women's store would want to put prom dresses on a website in January. Are the brick-and-mortar iterations of these stores also changing the way they merchandise?
Well, I can't speak specifically to that, because I speak mostly to the online marketing arms of the different department stores. But I would guess that a lot of bricks-and-mortar retailers are also factoring that data into some of their decisions. You know, a great example that's a little bit off of prom dresses is just how early we start to search for things like Halloween costumes and Christmas and holiday-related items. Halloween, actually, those searches started about 2 weeks ago, and they're just starting to ramp now. One of the things that we can do for both an online retailer and a bricks-and-mortar retailer is help them understand what are the top costumes that people are searching for. In fact, I just pulled that this morning before we got on the phone. The number one Halloween costume people are searching for right now? Bigfoot.
Bigfoot?
Bigfoot.
Why?
I think generating off that news story, the hoax around Bigfoot.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. But there's also some of the standard ones we see every year, like Tinkerbell Pirate, also very popular this year. And Lava Girl, I think, was up really high compared to where it was last year. But the bottom line here is that retailers now can look at this data well before Halloween actually hits, and they can start planning for what costumes they should be carrying in their stores.
Bill Tanser is my guest. His book is called Click, What Millions of People Are Doing Online and Why It Matters. I have found that I don't really like to shop, and many times before I go make a purchase, I will look online and compare prices and then walk into a brick and mortar and make my purchase. Do you know how common that is?
I think it's very, very common. You know, we don't actually measure the purchase behavior versus the visit behavior, so I can't tell you exactly how often it happens. But I can look at the difference, for example, in visits to comparison shopping sites like Shopping.com and Shopzilla versus the visits to the retailers and get a gauge for how many people are using the Internet as a tool to find the best price. Here's something that's really interesting is that as the economy has been in a slump, we had a hypothesis around what would be happening to online retail visits. And our guess was that they would decline along with declining bricks and mortar sales. What we found is that the opposite has been happening, that visits to online retailers has actually been increasing while the economy has been in a slump. And if you look at the numbers being reported by online retailers, while some have reported an increase, it's not as great an increase as we've seen in the visits to these sites. What that tells us is that people are really using the Internet more as a tool as times get tough to find those best deals and the best prices. In fact, those comparison shopping sites as a category year over year have increased 58% this year compared to the previous year. And we think, again, it's people using the Internet now as a tool to find the best price to really help stretch their dollar as far as they can.
How do people use review sites? You write about TripAdvisor in the book. Can you talk about how handy they are?
Yeah, you know, they're incredibly handy, but there's a flip side to this as well. And I talk about TripAdvisor in the book and just how it's really changed the landscape in the hospitality industry. I was at a conference. It was a travel conference attended by executives from hotel chains and airlines and cruise ships. And at the end of my presentation, a gentleman approached me and was talking about his hotel chain. He was the head of a five-star worldwide hotel chain. And he was telling me that his brand, while it used to be incredibly important, somewhat diluted by things like review sites like TripAdvisor, because nowadays consumers are armed with almost perfect information. They can look at all these different reviews, sometimes hundreds, even thousands of reviews on a specific property, and know exactly what they're getting into before they make the decision to reserve. And brand then becomes less important. You know, if I have an affinity to a certain brand, I might know that I would get a certain type of service and I'd be willing to pay a premium to reserve at that brand. But if I can instead read about all these different properties, I can make a very informed decision. So, you know, I talk about in the book, I was going to London, needed a place to stay. The hotel I wanted to stay at was booked. The hotel I actually booked at, before I walked in the room, using mostly TripAdvisor reviews, I knew what the room layout was going to be. I knew there'd be green marble in the bathroom. I knew when my feet hit the floor in the bathroom, it would be a heated floor, which is important in London in winter. I knew that Molton Brown products would be in the shower. I even knew the names of the front desk staff. I know who to ask for information. And most importantly, when I went to breakfast, which was supplied by the hotel, I knew to get the croissants and not the scones, even though I was in London, because the chef was from Paris. Now, the flip side to this, though, is that, you know, as these sites become more and more popular, there are a lot of shill reviews. There's a lot of textual vendettas that people have that show up within reviews. And there's also just differing viewpoints. And a lot of that can just lead to noise. And it's as they become more and more popular, it's getting harder for us to determine what's the valid review and what's going to really reflect our opinion when we actually visit one of these properties.
Is there research built to show whether the things that people read on these review sites ultimately tend to influence their own opinions about the products or services that they're consuming?
Yeah, that's a great point. I don't know of any research that addresses that specifically, but I would guess that that would be the case. It almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy at times. If I've read these reviews and I've immersed myself to the point where I understand things to this detail, maybe I'll actually see more of that detail when I visit the property.
Do you offer clients any advice if they have been had these online vendettas against them?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot you can do in terms of talking with the sites themselves that can help moderate some of these reviews. And there's also a lot of these sites offer the ability to address the concern openly in public, which might help diffuse a situation and get people to understand that there might be some sort of disagreement as to the level of service that was provided.
Bill Tanzer is my guest. He's General Manager of Global Research at Hitwise. His book is called Click, What Millions of People Are Doing Online and Why It Matters. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Up next, we'll talk about how the U.S. differs from other English-speaking countries in terms of what we search for.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Bill Tanzer is my guest. His new book is called Click, What Millions of People Are Doing Online and Why It Matters. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find John in Mesquite. Hi, John.
Hello. I'm hoping you haven't already addressed this question, but what is the source of the data that your guest is mining here? If he was from Google, I wouldn't need to ask this question, but is he somehow or other snooping on all of our internet traffic, or is he just got subscribing websites that pass on data to him, or where does all this come from?
We have addressed it, but no problem with repeating it. Bill has deals with internet service providers. Is that right?
Yeah, sure, John. So how we capture this data, our methodology is agreements with internet service providers. And first of all, let me say that end-user privacy is of utmost concern to us. We're not interested in tracking individuals, what individuals are searching on, and what sites individuals are going to. Rather, our interest is around aggregate trends. So what our agreements with ISPs, the way it works is the software on their servers captures the HTTP requests around visits to websites and the search terms that people are entering into search engines. But it groups it all together to rank what are the most popular searches, and it strips out all identifiable information about individuals and then dumps it to our server where we slice and dice it. So in our tool, what we see is this percent of the populace visited MySpace.com versus Facebook, or this percent of internet searches were searches for this specific term. So that's how we gather the information.
But there are some individuals who are willing to sort of opt in and allow you to collect information about their age and their zip code and that sort of thing.
That's correct. So the primary methodology accounts for 7.5 million of our 10 million sample. The other 2.5 million comes from an opt-in panel. And this panel has provided us with survey information. So they've told us their gender, their household income, their age, and also have provided the opt-in provider, or the panel provider, with their ZIP plus 4 address, which allows us to report on demographics of about 100,000 different sites and psychographic information on about 70,000 different sites.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. What is the difference between the kinds of things that Americans search for and, say, Canadians or people in the UK would search for?
So we gather data in the US. We also have data in the UK, Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand. And in some ways, there are a lot of big differences in the way people search. A lot of it just goes to the culture or the vernacular in any given country where we're gathering data. And it can be something as simple as somebody searching for tickets, which is very common when you're looking for a flight in the UK versus looking for flights in the US, how we search for things. What we're finding, though, which is really interesting, and sorry to bring this back to prom dresses, but we found that a lot of things that are very cultural and we would think very specific to the U.S. are actually crossing the pond and really breaking down the barriers in sometimes good ways, and you might view them as not so good ways, and culture just kind of crossing over the pond and disseminating through other cultures. And prom dresses is a great example. When I was going over to the U.K., the marketing manager for our company that manages the UK had heard about my reputation for talking about prom dresses ad nauseum. And she said, "Bill, whatever you do, don't talk about prom dresses here. It's the UK. We don't have the prom." And that was the worst thing she could have said to me. The first thing I did is I went into our UK sample and I started charting prom dresses. And sure enough, there was a massive amount of prom dress searches in the UK. And so, at this point, I'm fascinated. I clear my desk. I've got a lot of things I have to do that day, but I start, drilling down on prom dresses in the UK. I find a number of different websites that are UK-specific by Googling prom dresses, and I called up one of the proprietors there, this guy named Ollie, really friendly guy in the UK, and he said, we've been getting a flood of searches for prom dresses. In the UK, we have these end-of-school balls, but a lot of school-age kids in the UK are watching American television on cable and watching shows like The O.C. and other shows. They've started to try and assimilate some of the traditions that are in the U.S. into their own school year. In fact, I think just 6 months ago, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that talked about this prom phenomenon that was happening in the U.K., and it's that crossover. A lot of ways, our Internet activity is kind of becoming pretty much the same.
Hegemonic.
Hegemonic. That's the word I'm looking for across different countries.
I thought it was really interesting that you did similar research on the term wedding dresses and found that there's a spike at a certain season, but it sort of goes on and on. On the other hand, the search for engagement rings is what spikes for 1 week, and that's it.
Yeah, the big spike is actually 1 week, and that week is the week before Thanksgiving. And this was another thing discovered by one of my analysts. And in fact, we had this disagreement about the spike. The spike happens the week before Thanksgiving. And just like with prom dresses, we called up some retailers and we asked them, "What's your season for engagement rings?" And they said, "Well, Valentine's Day is popular. The most popular is the time between Thanksgiving and Christmas, because most engagements are happening on Christmas or on New Year's." So all of these online retailers were planning for after Thanksgiving, yet the massive spike happened the week before. So the disagreement I had with my analyst, her theory, she had the ultimatum theory. So her view was that a girl issues ultimatum to guy, says, "I'm bringing you home for the holidays, we're not going to go empty-handed," and that's what's causing the spike. I had a different theory. My theory is a research theory. It's a big purchase for anyone to go out and buy an engagement ring. So I subscribed to the theory that people were going online the week before actually going into the bricks and mortar store to start to understand engagement rings, understand pricing, understand the four C's. The thing, just like with prom dresses, though, is there's this inefficiency in the marketplace because retailers didn't understand that the searches occur a week earlier than they expected them to. They weren't doing anything to put engagement rings front and center on their site when they really should have, which is when people were looking for them.
It's interesting to think that presumably it's men who are making this decision, but they do it all after just a week of research.
Yeah, you know, that surprises me. And the short-term nature of our attention span always surprises me. You take searches on diets, for example. They spike January 1st. And without fail, I can predict that within 4 days, that spike's going to drop precipitously. So by January 5th, we're through with searching on diets.
And looking for brownie recipes.
Yes. I mean, we also can predict the bottom is going to be Thanksgiving Day. And about a week before New Year's, we're going to start those searches again, and we'll repeat.
So we don't keep our resolutions.
Well, we may or may not keep our resolutions, but the search term data just shows that, you know, for certain resolutions, we do have a short-term attention span.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Ken in Rome. Hi, Ken.
Hey there. I think your guest may have the answer to this, although it's a little bit of a digression. But I'm curious about online phone books and why they are so horrible and why, when I go to look up something in an online phone book, I even get frustrated before I start. And I'm wondering, and I think there's probably, you know, some kind of hidden story behind this that has to do with the dollar. Maybe the people at print phone books don't want to give the data. But why can't I see, like, a PDF of a printed phone book where I can scroll down through the Bakers in Fort Worth, Texas, or look for doctors in Euless or something like that. And instead, what I get is, say I'm looking for a moving company, and I'll see a list that says serving Fort Worth, and it turns out that it's really in, you know, Ohio or something like that. Why is that all so messed up?
Is that ad-driven, Bill?
Ken, I think that's a great question. I've noticed that as well, and I think there might be a couple of explanations. One, I actually come from a telco background. So back in the early to mid-90s, I was actually working within telecommunications for the phone companies. And I know a lot of the main yellow page and white page sites that are on the Internet are actually portions or parts of the former telcos. They're telco run, and I think that might account for some of the legacy. I can also tell you that searches and visits to those telephone directories, the traditional ones that you're so frustrated with, are declining. I think there is going to be survival of the fittest when it comes to sites like that. In our search term data, I can also tell you that people are doing traditional phone searches now more likely on search engines than they are in the past on these telephone directory sites. So I think in the long long term, we're going to see a battle between doing these phone searches on a search engine like Google, Yahoo Search, MSN Search, versus doing them on a traditional white page or yellow page site.
I know there has been a big business in teaching companies to optimize search results so that they'll pop up near the top of whatever terms that people put in. Is that getting in the way of sort of consumer interaction governing what falls at the top and what goes down to the bottom?
Yeah, that is a great question. And when we talk about the organic search results or the results that show up in the middle of the page, not the ads, there's a lot of things that companies can do to make sure that they show up top of results when someone searches on a topic that's specific to what they do. Now, the downside to that is that it's not only the companies that actually offer those services that are trying to get valuable content up to the top for people to see. It's also some people that might have some other agendas in terms of getting their content up there. Maybe it's getting some money from the end site or the advertiser. And because of that, there's this battle for truly getting the valuable information up top. Right now, the state of the art really is algorithms like what Google's using. And if you don't know how Google works, it's a two-part algorithm. One part looks at the relevancy of the content on a specific page to what you've typed. But the second piece of it is something that's called PageRank, which looks at how many people are linking to a specific site on that topic, and then judging how much relevancy that site has based on almost like reputation based on link. Those two things taken together tell the search engine where to put those results on the end search result page. But that also can be gamed. If you're a very savvy search engine optimizer, you can find ways to employ link farms to get a bunch of people to link to your site to get that content up. So it's going to be a constant battle, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I think there's going to be room in the future for another player to come in that's going to come up with an even better algorithm, or perhaps one of the existing search engines is going to find a way to arbitrate this battle between the two.
What's really interesting now is this thing that Google is doing where you begin to type any sort of search term in, and then a drop-down list comes up of what I imagine are the most common words and phrases that start with what you've begun to type.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and it's even extending further now with Google Chrome, which was just announced yesterday. The new Google browser is going to even suggest websites based on what you start to type into the URL bar. And like you said before, this could become something of a self-fulfilling prophecy. We might just see things in the suggestion that take us off on a path that we didn't originally intend.
Let's go very quickly to a final call from Raj in Dallas. Hi, Raj.
Hi, great show. Thanks a lot. And I have a very quick question. I'm a small business owner, and majority of my sales come from online sales. And it's been really interesting listening to you and not only looking at what keywords you use, but the trends and timelines around those keywords. What do you suggest are good resources and tools that we can use to understand how our customers or consumers purchase our products and what their buying behavior is made up of?
Well, you know, of course, there's the product my own company offers at Hitwise, but if you're a small business and you just want to try out some of these concepts, I urge you to go to sites like Google Trends, which will allow you to chart out some trends in consumer behavior and then make some calls as to how you're going to adjust your marketing programs based on those trends. And then when you actually see the value of that information, you may want to get a sample that's more representative of the entire internet population. And companies like the one I work for, Hitwise, can provide that information.
What does all your research tell you about the state of American spelling, or at least of their typing?
Yeah, and I'm probably one of the most guilty of some misspelled words. So there are quite a lot of misspellings that we find in our search term data. And it actually is one of the things that makes the analysis most difficult. You know, just doing this analysis on Sarah Palin for my Time column yesterday was looking at all the different ways people were trying to type her name in. Of course, that's understandable, but it also is a problem when we try and find trends to factor in all the different ways people might misspell a word. So, yes, it's prevalent, and it does make our job just a little bit harder.
I know that you sort of enjoy having a question that keeps you up at night and looking for relationships. Is there one in particular right now that you're trying to work through?
There is. I actually have a file on my desk of unsolved mysteries in search data. And the one that I've had now for 3.5 years is searches on baby names. They have very dramatic spikes that are very random, and I have not been able to associate those spikes with anything. I've assumed that it might have been something around celebrity births, but that didn't work out. We've actually provided the data to some economists and to some statisticians, and they're trying to figure out why these dramatic spikes happen. You know what I'll do is I'll post that chart again to my blog at weblogs.hitwise.com, and if anyone wants to take a look and comment on it, love to hear your ideas.
I have to check that out. Bill Tanser is General Manager of Global Research at the consulting firm Hitwise. His book is called Click, What Millions of People Are Doing Online and Why It Matters. Bill, it's been very interesting. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.